This week we head to South America and encounter massive human beings. These are known as giants. Average height is 8 feet. Many are up to 15 to 18 feet tall. This is on the island of Aruba off the coast of northern South America. These are known as Southern Caribbean Islands, and this is a race that has recently been discovered and was documented in the late 1400s, right after Columbus landed in Cuba. Our program today chronicles the history of these giants, where they came from, and their interaction with the mainlanders. All this and more today on Earth Ancients. For Saturday, September 17th, 2022, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning.
Down the castle hall he came, roaring,
Fee, Fi, Fo, Fum! Fee, Fi, Fo, Fum! Fee, Fi, Fo, Fum! Hee, Hi, Ho, Hum! I'm a most amazing guy. A most amazing guy, am I? Fee, fi, fo, fum. Hee, hi, ho.
That's Disney's Mickey and the Beanstalk. That's all about giants. The giants of cartoon land. Hey, welcome to Earth Ancients. This week we're talking about giants. We haven't had anybody on giants this year. I think the last time we had somebody was Hugh Newman, who had finished a book on England and the giants of England, Great Brittany, I guess you could call it, ancient Brittany. But we've had people on the program speaking on giants of Europe, the American giants. We had Greg Little and Andrew Collins write a book on the mound builders, which were giants. And there's lore and evidence of giants in Central America, parts of Australia. But today we're talking about South America, and specifically Aruba, which is a small island off the coast. I guess it's the Southern Caribbean islands that are of that we're going to focus on today. And you know, there's a lot to talk about when we're talking about giants. One of the fascinating things about this is that it seems to be a problem for orthodoxy to analyze, to give us any details about the humanoids that were giants, giant in stature, their artifacts, their dwellings. And from every indication, the giants that we have on record were fairly intelligent. And these guys not only built fascinating dwellings, they used monolithic size megaton size boulders to mark the seasons, to work with the various constellations. So someone handed this down to them, or they have a long lineage of cultures that were fairly intelligent, highly intelligent in some cases. Why scientists are not interested in this has been fascinating to me for many, many years. I came across the skulls and the bodies of the Paracas people in Paracas, Peru. This is some 30 years ago, and I found a pathologist who had made a study of the craniums, the heads of these people, and he determined that in the adult males of the Paracas culture, their brains were not bound whatsoever, and their cranial capacity was between 25 and 30% bigger than our own. That means they had 20+% more brain mass than we did. Now, does that make them more intelligent? I don't know. There isn't a great deal of evidence of sophisticated buildings in Paracas. In fact, we just find, you know, we find their cemeteries, their graveyards. We find some tombs. So what does this say to us? This could be that they were migratory people, that they came from somewhere else and migrated to Paracas, Peru. The other thing that is fascinating to consider is the fact that these people were fairly big. They're over 6 feet in many cases. Some of them are giants. They're almost 7 feet. And the bones are very thick, very heavy. The jaws are bigger than ours. Their teeth are unusual. And they have these massive heads. Now, is it possible that when they were alive 5, 6, 7,000 years ago, the Earth's gravitation was different? And if it was less gravity, perhaps this is what was the trigger for these big craniums, these massive heads. You don't see people like that today. Is it possible that our gravity was different? Is it possible? Well, I have to say it must be possible. And this is a big clue to where these people may have come from, what the Earth was like thousands and thousands of years ago, and why scientists have decided not to study these people. I mean, it makes you wonder. It really makes you wonder. Today's guest is all about Aruba, one of these islands. It's also close to Venezuela. So these are noted areas. These are heavily populated areas. But Aruba is a small country. It's only about 20 miles long by, I think it's 40 miles wide. We'll hear more about it today. Why universities have refused and continue to refuse to analyze these people is really a curiosity. Now, if you've been following us for a few years, you know that when we talk about giants, we bring up the Smithsonian Institute. And this has been curiosity to a lot of researchers, a lot of authors that we've had on this program. And some of the authors have actually reached out to the present day staff at Smithsonian, and many of them, because they're younger, are unaware of the history that this institution has of disposing of human giant bones, disposing of artifacts that are from races of people that are in question. But, you know, why they do these things, why they would dispose of thousands of mound builder bones and other curiosities from the United States, you know, it really calls into question what their ethics are. Is this a religious problem? Do giants make people think of the Bible and some of the stories of the giants of the Bible, the Nephilim, and other races that were of gigantic size? Who's the most famous biblical giant? Well, that's Goliath. And some people believe that Goliath was an actual being from a clan or a race of giants. When you see him depicted in various illustrations, he's monstrous. He's over 20 feet tall in some cases. Some people even have him taller than 18 or 20 feet. Today, we're actually going to talk about some giants that are at minimum 12 to 18 feet. And luckily, and this is one of the big things about giants, we have photographs that our guest today has taken that you can see up close and personal on the island of Aruba. And this makes this even more fascinating and more, actually, you know, it actually solidifies the whole idea of huge, giant humans. So fascinating. Again, I'm just going to belay the point here. Why are universities not studying these unusual humans? Well, again, is it biblical? Is it because the religious churches would get upset? It would maybe call into question our past. You know, we haven't been just Homo sapiens sapiens. I don't know. I mean, there's hobbits, these miniature humanoids. There are the Denefisins. There are the Neanderthals. What the hell? Why can't we have a research project on the Paracas people or giants around the world? Hell, I'd buy that book. You know, these academics are always unhappy when people outside of their field venture in to academic subject matter, write a book, they become bestsellers, and all of a sudden their notoriety is huge. And these poor academics are out there doing field research, and their books are just placed in university shelves to gather dust. So I have no clue. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, though. And we're going to hear today from our guest on her concerns as to why this topic is not being taken seriously. And in some cases, and this happens on the island of Aruba, bones disappear. Skeletal remains disappear. Artifacts disappear. And this is not good. So today, we are talking about giants from Aruba. Really great interview. My guest today is Heather Arnold. She's got an upcoming book called Aruba, The Island of the Giants. Spoken to a number of research investigators and authors from different parts of the world who are, you know, really looking into the aspects of very, very tall humans. In fact, we changed the category from tall humans to giants, because when you're looking at somebody who has the bone structure that weighs close to 400 pounds, that's not just a tall person. That's a huge human. We've had Hugh Newman on the program, speaking about giants in Europe, in England. Greg Little spoke to us about the mound builders in the United States and the giants that were found at the turn of the century. My guest today has actually found evidence of giants in South America. We haven't been to South America, and this is something entirely new, kind of exciting on many levels. And we're going to hear shortly just what she has found. My guest today is Heather Arnold. She is a research investigator out of New York who has spent a great deal of time in Aruba, which are Southern Caribbean islands. And I didn't know anything about this until I saw a video that she produced. And fascinating to consider just a whole nother aspect of ancient humans that we just don't know about. So, hey, Heather, welcome to Earth Ancients. Great to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Cliff. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate your invitation.
Great to have you. All right, let's start from the top. What, you talk about your interest in Aruba from a tourist point of view. Is this kind of the background of your research? You were learning about the culture, and all of a sudden you bumped into myths of giants? Or how did that start? How did your research begin?
Well, thank you for asking. So I was starting a tour company when I lived in Aruba, and I wanted the tours to be as historically accurate as possible. So my tours were private Jeep tours and Harley Davidson rentals and tours. And so I wanted to add something different, and I wanted that difference to be the history of the islands. And when I say the islands, I mean Aruba, Bonaire, and Curacao. Curaçao. All three of those islands in the 1502 map of the islands were known as the Islands of the Giants. Actually, Bonaire was later, but Aruba and Curaçao were known as the Islands of the Giants. So I began to do my own research just on the island and noticed a situation with the petroglyphs, how the petroglyphs on Aruba, which has a rich amount of petroglyph sites, were similar to petroglyphs I had seen out west, New Mexico, Arizona, in Europe, even in South America, even on Easter Island. So I begin to draw some conclusions, such as Aruba being part of this global, what I believe and theorize to be a global civilization that had existed eons ago. In Aruba's case, they say at least 5,000 to 7,000 years ago, but I think personally much longer ago. Mm-hmm. And it was from that point that I began to research the history of the island. What is the history of the island in terms of the ancient history? And it's very hard to ascertain. I understood that the children in school in the islands, they're taught that the islands were called the Useless Islands. And I was immediately, my interest piqued because I knew that there was gold on the island. Mm-hmm. And I knew that gold would not make an island useless by any means. So I didn't know if this was some sort of distractionary tactic by the early explorers to get people's eyes off the island. But I did know that it was quite disheartening for a community to hear that their islands were named Useless Islands. And I knew that it just didn't make sense. And then I stumbled across a speech given by an archaeologist who's still an archaeologist today at the museum. And I'm actually close friends with him. And he started talking about the 500-year birthday of Aruba. And the birthday was attributed to the time that Vespucci and his men came to the island in 1499 AD. And so I was reading it, and I actually agreed. He's saying, why are we starting the birthday of 500 years when we've had this thousands of years history on this island? But then he started going off on giants on the island and started saying, you know, there are no giants on the island. There's no documentation of the giants on the island. And then I thought, oh my gosh, who's even asking about this? Why is he bringing this up? And I immediately realized perhaps there were actually giants on the islands. Mm-hmm. And then I began to do research in the archaeological record.
Because let me stop you real quick for a second, Heather.
Of course, please.
I want to go back. What's so appealing about Aruba? I've never been to that part of the world. I've been to the Caribbean side of Mexico, Tulum, and things like that, which isn't too far. But what's the beauty? What's the attraction to Aruba and the neighboring islands?
Yeah, it's a great question because, I always say that I didn't find the giants found me. I think the islands, one thing that's great of great appeal of the three islands is that they're outside of the hurricane belt. So for tourism, yes, they are not affected. Now, they can get waves and winds and some rains, but they're never going to get a full-blown hurricane. They're not in a direct hit zone. So for cruises and for tourists in general, it's a very, quote-unquote, safe place to go and a safe place in terms of safety, personal safety. And for me, as when I first went to Aruba, I felt like I was home. You know, I felt like I had a deep connection with the island. And compared to other Caribbean islands, it's interesting. It's not like other Caribbean islands in that it's not lush and green and mountainous like some, for example, the British Virgin Islands. It is an arid, semi-arid desert island. There are cacti, but some palm trees, and there's some green during rainy season. Mm-hmm. But the appeal is also the weather. It's pretty consistent. They get very little rain, obviously, each year, being outside the hurricane belt. And it's highly accessible from the United States. I mean, I think in New York, we have like 10 flights a day that fly direct.
Oh, it is very well visited. What's the actual size? I think you mentioned 20 miles by something. Doesn't sound very big.
Yes. No, it's a little bigger than Manhattan Island. It's 20 miles long and 9 miles wide. So, which is so amazing that it has such a rich archaeological history because it is such a small island, but most of it is underdeveloped. So, for example, thankfully, the government acknowledges the importance of the ecology, the fauna, the flora of the island, and has preserved a large swath of the island for its national park. So the national park is protected. And then there are other parts of the island that are protected archaeologically. And so no one can build there or dig there and or have tourists there, et cetera. But they are protected sites.
And so the Dutch are the ones who still occupy and oversee the governance of the islands.
Exactly. So Bonaire is more part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands than Aruba and Curaçao. They have their independent governments, but they all dial into the Kingdom of the Netherlands. So Bonaire is completely a part of the Netherlands. So you don't need a visa or anything to even stay if you have a Dutch passport. But if you have a Dutch passport and you come to stay in Curaçao and Aruba, you will have to go through the same machinations that I have to go through when I want to stay on the island for a longer period of time. So they really are trying to preserve their people and their culture. And if you go to Bonaire, my daughter is Aruban, so she has relatives there. We see her Bonairean relatives. But a lot of the island is Dutch. So it's almost like you're in a Caribbean Holland. And
Interesting. Without the windmills.
Exactly. And the cold and the rain and the darkness. Yeah, so exactly. In the canals, but it's a beautiful. I mean, Bonaire is one of my favorite islands on Earth. But yes, it's you know, everyone is very well educated. They speak at least 5 languages.
Wow,
it's very easy to get around. They all accept the U.S. dollar and have local currency, except for Bonaire, it just has the U.S. dollar. So it is one of the most Aruba has the most repeat visitors of any Caribbean island. So
it must be pretty nice if that's the case. Yes, people are coming back. Well, let's talk about some of your early research. You mentioned Vespucci and his early documentation. He really not only perhaps landed on Aruba, but he began documenting these giants. Tell us a little bit about what he found when he got there.
You know, I'm so thankful for Vespucci. I mean, I understand that the colonialism harbors a lot of wounds, but there was a benefit to some of it. You always have to look at that to offset the negatives that could have occurred. So for Vespucci, this was an archaeological expedition in and of itself, in a sense. So he took with him on his ships botanists, physicians, pharmacists, not just for the health and safety of the crew, but also for the search and quest for knowledge that would be printed in books and articles that he was going to write and present to the sovereigns of Europe, as well as the people of Europe. Mm-hmm. And so he documents in great detail the lifestyles, the food choices, the appearance, the way people are living, the culture, etc., of the people he encounters. And so he was the first to come to the island of the giants. And the way he found out about it was because Columbus was he had established deep relationships with the mainland people of which is now Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And he developed these relationships with them. And they were the ones who recounted to him stories of the giants on Aruba. And Aruba is visitable from Venezuela and vice versa. It's only 16 miles apart. So it was very easy for anyone, even in a canoe. There are a swimming contest back and forth. Actually, that's how easy. Although there are shark-infested waters, and I would never do that. Yeah. Kayaking competitions, etc. So it is possible to go easily, not without some challenges, but to the different locations.
Vespucci, did he intend to follow Columbus's path and go to Cuba down to the Caribbean islands, or did he directly come from Europe straight to Aruba?
Well, he stopped at other islands prior. So he stopped at an island off the coast, and he doesn't use the names we use today, right? So we have to use the map of Juan de la Cosa, one of the best cartographers in the history of the world, actually, who created this Mappus Mundi in 1502. He had to rely on Juan de la Cosa's information, who had been on all the voyages with Columbus. As a matter of fact, he owned the Santa Maria. He was the one who was plotting these islands. And so using the information from Juan de la Cosa of where these places were located, coupled with the information that Columbus had gleaned from the mainland South Americans, detailing the giants in Aruba and the possible presence of gold on those islands, is what motivated Vespucci to go to those islands. So once Vespucci essentially absconded through slightly devious means, Columbus's permit to be the sole explorer in the New World, he set his sights straight away on going to Aruba. And he didn't go right away. So first he went to a couple of islands off the coast of Colombia, where he actually witnessed seeing a human being cooked over a fire, cannibalistic activities. Wow. And so it wasn't until, and the only place he documents as thinking he was going to die was in Aruba with his encounter with the giants.
Yeah, I want you to talk about that. He came across three young women, and go ahead and tell the story, because this is absolutely incredible. Go ahead.
So this is all documented in his book, Letters to the New World.
Okay.
And it is, you can get it from the library. It's pretty accessible. It's in English. It's in many different languages, not just English. And so these are his words. So he traveled to Aruba with this group of men, and they reached the beach. They reached the shores. And once they reached the shore of what is Aruba, now it's believed to be Curaçao, but I worked with a cartographer who is actually getting his PhD currently in cartography. He also has two masters, and he's based out of Belgium. And he figured out that it was the most accurate placement of Aruba and Curaçao of any of the ancient maps, because of the way that they used the latitude, that you could determine that those were exactly the islands, and Aruba was exactly the island he went to and not Curaçao.
Okay.
And he saw these large footprints in the sand. So he was immediately intrigued. And they began to follow the footprints when they came across actually four women. Two appeared to them to be a grandmother, a mother, and two teenage girls, maybe 15, 16. Yeah. And he couldn't believe how tall they were. He was amazed at their size. All of them were. And they followed the women into their village, which was in a clearing. He described what the homes were made of and how they were arranged within this clearing. And they began to try to communicate with each other, and the communication was not working. He was offered brackish water, which actually makes very good sense, even health-wise, that people living on the equator would drink brackish water, which means that there's a salt content in that water that could deter from dehydration. And at some point he decides with the men, let's take the teenage girls. We'll take them, we'll bring them back to the ship, and then we'll bring them to Europe as gifts to the sovereigns. And as they're trying to formulate this plan of attack, essentially, in walked 36 men. And these men were even taller than the women. As a matter of fact, the teenage girls were so tall that Vespucci said if he were standing and they were kneeling, they would still be towering over he and his men.
So they must have been in the mid high teens, like 15 to 18 feet.
I mean, you would have to think at least that. Now, Vespucci, everyone says, well, Vespucci, one of the arguments I get is Vespucci was short. you know, the Europeans were short at that time.
Yeah.
And from the, I've read many biographies of Vespucci, history books of Vespucci. And it was, from my estimation, he was at least 6 feet tall. Hmm. So he wasn't a short guy. Yeah. Of course, yeah. Some Europeans weren't very tall at that time, but he wasn't one of those Europeans. And even today's standard, he would be, you know, a fairly decent tall man.
Right.
So if they were even taller than he was, and using his calculations, I came up with at least 12 feet. So obviously it could give or take, but
that's a lot even by today. When you look at people like Shaq, who's 7'2" and a huge human being, 12 feet is, that's huge. That's like, oh my God, that's something to look at.
And Cliff, it wasn't even just their height that was impressive. It's their width. I mean, these were massive people. Yeah. They were not like gangly NBA players, you know, tall but thin. These were massive people. They were very wide, as well as their bones being larger than the average statured human. As a matter of fact, so large and so thick, including their skulls, which were elongated, that one of the archaeologists talked about having to invent his own saw to get through the bones of the skeletal remains, because of the normal cadaver saws were breaking upon trying to use them on the giant's bones.
So, they had very heavy bones.
Very heavy bones.
Before we get into some characteristics, what did the Vespucci, how did he describe their appearance? What were they wearing?
So he said they were naked, and he said they had long black hair, very long. And he didn't really describe their skin, but he just said that they were had long hair. Now, it's interesting because the archaeologists determined that, based off the skeletal remains that they have found, that the giants of Aruba, Bonaire, and Curaçao had light hair. So this is actually an interesting component. So I tend to appreciate the firsthand knowledge of someone when the person was actually living. So from Vespucci, he describes them as having long hair and naked. He does describe them as having massive weaponry, weapons that he couldn't even figure out. Were they hunting? Were they killing people? Were they going after people? He said that those weapons that the 36 men were carrying, he couldn't even probably carry one with three people. That's how heavy and big that they appeared to be.
And what were these, like bone arrows, knives, axes? What does he describe?
He describes them in detail. They appear to be bludgeoning tools, things of this nature, not really swords and also some arrows, definitely spears, bows and arrows and spears. He describes the spearheads of being enormous. And he describes one of them as having this very strong, sturdy, long stick, which was probably made of Brazil wood, which is very hard to break. And then this massive stone on the end, but he wasn't quite sure what that would be used for. And it was those weapons coupled with the height of these men that deterred them from moving forward with their master plan of kidnapping those poor young girls.
Oh my God. So 36 men show up to Vespucci's living quarters and basically say, don't even think about this, or what?
Well, once they showed up, they began to have a communication breakdown, and this got Vespucci nervous, and he aborted mission, and they all decided, let's head back to the ship. So they're going through the Brazil wood trees, getting closer to the coast, and all the while, the giants are right behind them. They're following them right behind. And they get into the ship, and the giants are still coming. They're walking into the water now. So they're so tall that there's still a presence even within the water. So Vespucci gets very nervous at this point, and then the giants start shooting bows and arrows at them. And Vespucci decides, let's shoot a cannon off just to scare them. He said not, and he says in his letters, not to kill them, just to scare them. And it works. And the giants retreat, and then they leave. Vespucci and his men, they go back to what is now mainland Venezuela. And he writes in his letter that this is a day I thought I was going to die. And he was very scared from that experience. And it was after that that he concludes, from this experience, I named this island the island of the giants because of the large statured people that are there.
And so he did that in what, when he was there?
1499.
1499. Okay.
Exactly.
So he didn't even stay on the island. He got out of there and went back to the mainland, huh?
Exactly. He hightailed it out of there. Yes.
So, what history do we know about these people? What did he collect in his book that gives us a hint as to their origins?
Yeah, their origins are unknown to this day. Unknown. Archaeologists don't know. Of course, there is a creation story that is told amongst the local people, and it starts in Bonaire. And in Bonaire is a stone called the Mother Stone, and it's a huge monolith of limestone that faces the ocean. And within the center of this limestone monolith is an indentation that is said to be the navel. So this stone is referred to as the navel of the world, which is interesting because I've been also to Rapa Nui, to Easter Island, and there is also a navel of the world, which has a creation story attached to it. So the people of the islands say that it through that navel, the giants emerged. And that navel is connected through an umbilical cord to the center of the earth. And in the center of the earth is the mother being, the divine mother. Mm-hmm. Not maybe necessarily a physical mother, but maybe a life force. And it was through this umbilical cord and out this navel of the stone and bone air that the first giants emerged. And so that's really the only story we have of their existence on those islands. Now, Aruba, Bonaire, Curaçao were actually one island at one point. Mm-hmm. It was geological evidence shows that through a series of mega tsunamis starting in 3500 BC, that these islands were separated. And there is a lot of seismic activity in that area of the world. So that actually makes sense. And there is geological evidence of both islands, of all three islands, on all the three other islands, showing that it was probably for sure that those three islands were one. But they were never connected to the mainland. So that's quite interesting. So people always wonder, well, how did the original inhabitants get there? And no one really knows. Now, there were two breakaway civilizations that were uncovered by archaeologists. One is in the rainforests of Colombia, in a very remote location. And the other is in the caves of Cuba. So it obviously these people traveled. They clearly most likely traveled by boat. And there is a possibility that the giants of those islands of Aruba, Bonaire, and Curaçao maybe came from somewhere else.
Well, I wanted to ask you this because when we look into the Spanish arriving in Florida, there are stories of giants there. And I'm just curious if you came, of course, this is in your book, but if you came across any similarities that you would say, yeah, this could be a line from the same species of humanoids.
Yeah, that's a great point. So in 1970, there was a man named Christopher Engels from Holland who resided in Curaçao. And he heard about Vespucci's legends and read his letters and knew the history. And he was convinced that there were giants in Aruba. And he commissioned a team to go into Aruba and start unearthing skeletons in one of the oldest, most expansive cemeteries in the Caribbean, but happens to be in Aruba, called Malmuk. And it was from there that because the skeletons were so old, he could not extract them from the earth. They just fell to sand and dust. And so he was able, though, to extract two skulls. And he brought them back to Curaçao. He could not find any scientists to research these skeletons. No one would go near these two skulls with a 10-foot pole. But he did finally attract the interest of the head of research of the Tropical Museum in Amsterdam. And she is a physical anthropologist. She flew over from the Netherlands and came and researched the skulls. And she determined through her observations that are written in the archaeological report that was published in 1970, that the closest other species of human, other type of human that she's seen that is of this height were those Indians found in Florida. And that's her direct words, but they're in French, actually. So she determined that they were might have been closely related to them.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
But she found other anatomical differences that seemed to separate them. And she felt that the giant skulls that she had seen from Aruba were actually larger than the native populations that she had encountered in Florida.
Okay.
So part of that was the anatomical differences.
Let's talk about that. Why don't you give us a breakdown of these Aruban giants? And because there's some very fascinating characteristics that you have discovered. Go ahead and give us the breakdown.
Sure. So one of them is the location of where the head meets the base of the neck. So the reason why this is important is because the skulls of Aruba have been found to be elongated. Of Aruba, Bonet, and Curacao, the giants have elongated skulls. The elongation of these skulls is not up straight, like, for example, like the cone head type skulls of Paracas, Peru. They're not of that nature, but they go up and then back. So a majority of the brain case is located towards the back of the skull, and this part of the skull is elongated. It's stretched.
Okay, let me stop you real quickly. So what we know about the Paracas people is that in the largest examples of their cranial cavities, they're about 30% more than average humans. So that's our brain, and then you add another 30% more brain capacity. What do we see in Aruban craniums?
Very, very similar. As a matter of fact, the archaeologists make mention of how, because at this time, also archaeologists were looking for lesser people, right? Mm-hmm. They think everyone except for modern humans, they're lesser than that. They can't, they're almost like cavemen, you know, the stereotypical caveman. But they're shocked at the size of these brain cases and the thickness of the skull. And they're looking frantically for evidence of headboarding, of this head binding that still continues to this day, in my belief, it's to emulate the giants, yeah, or at least those who had the elongated skulls. And so they can't find any evidence of that. And then they find a fetus, and the fetus has an elongated skull. And now they have to determine, maybe under duress, that these people were born with elongated skulls. And the reason why the fetus throws is the monkey wrench in all of their theory is because it takes at least 6 months for a baby after they're born to have their head become that cone shape through the head binding.
Right.
But if a baby is not even born yet and has an elongated skull, then clearly this is a genetic characteristic of these people. So that was something that was intriguing to them. So yes, as a matter of fact, one of the tidbits of information passed on to Columbus by the mainland people of Venezuela, what is now Venezuela, was that the giants of Aruba were more advanced and worshiped the sun, which was another component. So I have found megaliths on the island that coincide with cosmic events, solstices, equinoxes, supermoons.
So there's an intelligence there that we're beginning to understand. They had a cosmology, perhaps, of their own.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's really too bad that Vespucci upset these guys, because it would be great to know their ancestral history, wouldn't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's so much I want to know about them. But ultimately, I think through my research, I've determined that there is a connection between those giants and the giants found globally contemporaneously with the giants of Aruba. So now, just with new dating techniques, and there's so much more technology that will come out in the years to come. But first, it was determined that the earliest giants on the island were 5,000 years ago, that was the original presence. But now new dating has pushed them back even further to 7,000 years. I personally think, because the oldest skeletal remains found in that area were 11,000 years old, I could think that it's possible that they could even be pre-flood or Younger Dryas.
Well, this is why I want to ask you real quickly, Heather, and then I want you to continue on with your description of these physical attributes. Do you have a sense that these could be left over from perhaps Atlan or Atlantis, simply because the Caribbean was the most southern portion of the great continent? And there's always been rumors, Edgar Cayce, people like that, saying that there were giants that were a phase of the Atlantean culture. What do you say to that?
I think that's, you know, I never rule anything out. So I think it's very possible. There are petroglyphs on the island that seem to emulate this cup and ring motif that seems to designate some sort of architecture of Atlantis. Also, these islands are part of the Lesser Antilles, and the earlier explorers named these islands the Antilles, meaning of Attilia, which was considered Atlantis, because the early explorers felt that these were the islands were remnants of the cataclysm that occurred to Atlantis. So I think it's very possible. Now, the archaeologist at the Archaeology Museum, he thinks that they are from Egypt, which is even more interesting, that there was a possible land bridge and that they came up from Africa to South America and up into the islands and eventually into North America, which is even more intriguing. And
wow,
something I would love to go into further.
We're going to take a short commercial break, and we will return with my guest today, Heather Arnold, speaking on giants from the island of Aruba. We'll be right back. My guest today is author and research investigator Heather Arnold, who has made a study of the giants who populated a small island called Aruba off the South American coast. And we are hearing about the history of these people, where they went to, and their remains. Go ahead and continue on. One of the things I was curious about is that you talk about the teeth on these guys, and that's a very important consideration. If they're meat eaters, your feet, your teeth are of a certain quality. If you're what do they call it when you're eating vegetables? That's a different type of denture. Talk a little bit about their teeth.
So their teeth are shovel shaped, which is, and large, very large teeth and shovel shaped. Shovel shaped teeth are also found in the Denisovans. So it's quite interesting to have that comparison.
Wow.
And
yeah,
they appear to be shovel shaped in my theory is to accommodate what they were using their teeth for. And I think they weren't just eating with the teeth, but they were using the teeth even as tools.
Okay.
So, which is my estimation. So they also, when you find the skeletal remains of the giants, you'll see they have almost all of their teeth still intact. Some of them ground down almost to the bone. So they were definitely living a very long life, a robust life. They were clearly eating well. They were oldest documented burial was a 45-year-old female in the largest cemetery in Aruba. And so they definitely, I believe, were using their teeth to maybe crack open mollusks. They were huge shellfish eaters, and they were almost worn down completely, but they had shovel-shaped incisors that are much larger than modern human teeth, as well as the jaw. So the jaw, the lower jaw in particular, the way it connects to the cranium is totally different than how it connects to in a modern human. And that's to accommodate the width of the skull, because the skull was very large. And the lower jaws were considered very large and had full rows of teeth, not double rows of teeth. There's no instances of double rows of teeth in the Caribbean giants.
Okay, fascinating. What else do we know? I mean, you talk about the density of the bones of these giants. They're very big, obviously, but very thick as well. That means that they were very muscled, perhaps. Is that is that the characteristic?
That's exactly what they think. They think they were enormous people, not just their height, but their weight. They definitely made them enormous. And even their burials. Now, the bones shrink. And another interesting thing to think about is it's so frustrating. So there is a giant skeleton on display in Bonaire. It's in a private archaeology museum in Bonaire, and I'm hoping to go back to it next year. And so the estimates of the size of the giants is determined by a mathematical calculation that gives you a percentage. So this is very frustrating because you never can really get the full idea of how large these giants were. However, in the case of the Bonaire skeleton that was discovered in 1980, while they were building a bus stop for a school in the capital of Bonaire, they estimated that this giant was at least 8 feet tall, if not taller. And it was the archaeologist's conclusion at the end of the scientific report that Vespucci was finally vindicated, that they had finally found physical proof of the giants. And that's why they have such a span of 8 feet or taller, could be as tall as 12 feet in another instance, the investigators say, because they're using mathematics and because the bones shrink. But the skull, even with this skeletal remains, and it's all crumpled into the fetal position, which isn't even the way it was found, into this little box in the corner of the museum. It's kind of interesting because it's always these more controversial finds that are almost treated as a joke, but they're actually real. It's interesting. You'll find this sometimes. For example, with the Tucson artifacts, you'll see this as well, that are housed in Arizona. So the skull is very large. And the other part of that skull that's interesting are the eyes were enormous. So these didn't necessarily look, you would think that they're human because they have human features and appearances, but then other parts of them seemed very bizarre, such as their eyes, where their ears were located.
So they might have looked a little different than us. But they, I mean, absolutely. They're obviously humanoid, but they're just maybe different. You know, it's funny. One of my big problems, Heather, is that every time I have somebody talking about giants, it's like, where are the bones? Show me a humor. Show me a finger. Show me something. No one can ever deliver it. You actually have a picture of this Bonaire skeleton, the male, estimated to be 1,000 years old, which I also think is pretty amazing. And the way the photograph, and by the way, we'll post this photograph for people to look at from your video. It's almost disrespectful what they did to the body. What's that all about? Is it because he's an anomaly that they decided to kind of maybe not treat with the skeleton with a great deal of respect. What's that all about?
I think it's inconvenient. So this guy is inconvenient. Okay. They want him to go away, but he's there. Yeah. And they can't, you know, sweep him under the rug. He's too big. So it's they're forced to face it, but they don't want to face it. And so he's crumpled up in a corner, in a case that you would put like a map in or something. It's not even what I would consider appropriate on any level.
They kind of just dumped the bones in a little box.
And it's a private collection. So all the requirements for climate, and I'm not saying he's being, you know, not preserved in the best way, because now there's a new owner of the skeleton. Okay. And this happened during the pandemic. So this is why I want to get to Bonaire very quickly to see, you know, the condition of the skeleton, because it's a new owner. And so, yeah, I feel it's very disrespectful. And because he's inconvenient now. The two skulls I spoke of earlier, discovered by Chris Engels in 1970, he couldn't find a museum to even house those skulls. No, there's an archaeology museum in Curaçao. They would not accept the skulls. And the Rubin Archaeology Museum was not in existence yet. Now it is, but its sister museum is the Smithsonian. So I don't know.
Oh, God. Oh, help. God help us if those guys get involved. We'll never see anything ever again.
So he eventually, Chris Engels, had to develop his own museum to house these skulls. And he put them in the museum. And actually in 1980, a reporter from the Reading Eagle, which is a newspaper still in publication in Pennsylvania, wrote about seeing the skulls and saying that they were from the ancient race who used to live on the island, and it was a giant. They were giants. And so I was looking for these skulls and hoping to repatriate them to Aruba, where they were taken from. And it turns out now they're missing. So there was a renovation in this museum. Chris Engels, by the way, was killed standing on a street corner shortly after his research was published, which is another odd.
What the heck is going on with these people that are reporting on anomalies? You know, it's like
very strange. Very strange.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed over here. Rabbit's feet and all. So, I can't find the skulls. They think they're in Holland. They might be at the University of Leiden. If anyone knows, that would be wonderful to help me. Because my goal is to get these skulls back. But again, they were in the basement. It's really these inconvenient truths that people don't really want to draw too much attention to, but still seem to feel compelled to display them. And yeah, it's very disrespectful how that giant is treated.
But you do have the Bonaire skeleton, and he, even though he's in private museum, you have excellent photographs of him. It'd be great to get somebody a pathologist to look at his cranial vault and the skull. I mean, it's huge, you know.
It's huge.
So,
and maybe even DNA. Now, originally, the anthropologist who came to look at the first two skulls found in 1970, her last words in her report were, I would like to do DNA analysis on the teeth, because she found enough material to do DNA analysis. And then she got on a plane to fly down to Peru to do more research, and her plane crashed. So that was the end. She died. So we never got more DNA. We have still to this day.
What the heck is going on with these poor researchers?
I know. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, I burn a lot of sage.
it's very, very strange. You make a good point in your short video when the question comes up, where did these people go? And your suggestion, which is very likely the true story, is that they began interbreeding with the regular humans. Talk a little bit about your hypothesis about where they may have gone off to.
Yes, that's great observation. So that's one of the most common questions I've asked. And in 2002, a group of geneticists did an analysis of the people of Aruba, and they wanted to determine their genetics. And mm-hmm. they determined, going back three generations, and these three generations could not have ever left the island. And Aruba is actually perfect for this because there weren't a lot of influx of different people on the island because there were never an ability to have crops or have any sort of plantations due to the arid climate of the island. So the genetic material of the people is relatively intact. And so these geneticists determined that there's a part of their DNA that must be part of the ancient, archaic, original inhabitants of Aruba. It is not connected to any genetic material that is known or that has been known of. And so that this genetic material is still being carried on in modern Aruban to this day. And because I found what I believe is a birthing chamber in Aruba, it's a very inaccessible spot. And there's actually a petroglyph in that cave, of the chamber. It's a cave, but that's been worked, of a woman who looks like she has a baby in her stomach. Mm. And on the wall are ticks, these little lines. And what my studies have concluded is that this was a birthing chamber denoting births, how many births were taking place. And there weren't a lot of births. There weren't a lot of giants. Although these were the leaders, this was the elite class, there weren't a lot of them. So I believe that at some point, they began to run out of giants to breed with, and they began to mate with average statured humans. And that is what the genetic information tells us. And wow. Which would make sense. If you're a dying race, you're going to keep going on with whomever you can, particularly if you're running out of giants.
Mm, amazing. I want you to talk a little bit about what appears to be cosmology and perhaps a lost science. What you found and what you're currently chronicling, and we'll get probably a good sense of this when the book comes out, is these monolithic stones. You call them megaliths, but it could be either way. And we're not talking small stones. We're talking about stones set on top of other stones that are huge. And you hint in your talk that I saw that they could have a special alignment. Talk a little bit about that.
So I began to notice in Aruba these huge balance stones. Now, I live in New York, not far from the balance stone, which is about 60 tons.
That's a dolmen, though, because it's got little feet. These are the ones in Aruba aren't dolmen, are they?
Some are. Some.
Oh, really?
Some have been collapsed. So there's one, for example, in Iowa Rock Formation, that I believe had some destruction due to tsunamis. Okay. And this one was on little tiny stones and it aligns with the equinox. Wow. That has now fallen, but beneath it, you can still see the stones. There are still two stones propping it up, and you can see the equinox sun rise
right
up the bottom of that stone area, which is exactly what occurs with the balanced rock in Salem, North Salem, New York. As a matter of fact, it's right under the stone where the illumination occurs. So once I started realizing, wow, these are massive stones, I began to plot them on a map. With their longitude and latitude and their GPS coordinates. And then I begin to put the call out to other people in Aruba and Curacao and Bonaire. If they're aware of any of these other balanced stones, there has to be more. That my research in megaliths and monoliths is where there's one, there is could be 100. So yeah. Then locals start saying, well, I have one on my property and there's one behind my house. And I began to piece together all these monolithic stones, and they are definitely, some of the stones are enormous, maybe three times the size of the balance stone in North Salem, New York. And they are sometimes of a different stone than the one beneath it. So it will be diorite on top and tonalite beneath it. Although they're still same type of stone, they're from two different areas. And there were never glaciers in Aruba. There was no ice age in Aruba. So these were clearly moved.
So there's no quarries in any of those islands that they would cut these stones and drag them. Is that what you're saying?
Not these stones. No. Now, on the grave sites, there are stones that were quarried, but they're much smaller. I mean, they're manageable. You could, you know, almost like little, like a gravestone, for example, and mm-hmm. stone circles. And I mean, although they are huge, I would need help, a lot of help carrying some of these enormous slabs of limestone.
Yeah.
And they're limestone, too, as a matter of fact. And they're not necessarily diorite. The diorite stones on top of the burials were reserved for the real high elite burials of the giants, probably because it's the hardest stone and it's hard to get out of the ground and it took the most work.
Yeah.
But these were massive stones. And when I start to plot them to make sure it wasn't a coincidence, you start to see a pattern. And the pattern is that these stones run northwest to southeast, intersecting the island diagonally in parallel lines. So right now we have four parallel lines that I've documented, which also align to the petroglyph sites. So along the lines of these balanced stones, you will also find the petroglyph sites and some burials as well. So what I've found is that these stones are pointing. Some of them are pointing to another balance stone. Some of them are pointing to a burial. Some of them are pointing to a petroglyph site. Some of them are pointing to a cave. But they're all directional. And it's this happening by coincidence is it's non-existent. And these are massive stones. And yeah. how they were moved to this day is baffling without any technology, if we're to believe that, at least modern technology.
Yeah, I mean, these stones, and I hope we can get a few for our Facebook page to give people an idea of what we're talking about. These are not small. They're several tons placed together in specific alignments, and you're telling us about the alignments. And so we'd love to see a few of those, Heather.
Definitely.
I don't want to give your book away, but if we can have a few, then we can kind of give we'll call it a prelude to the launch of your book. How's that?
Sure, of course. Yes. Okay. And I always have, like, I have my little daughter sitting there under
of
the
course. Stone. Well, that's good because we get a perspective as exactly. as to the size of the stones. One thing that doesn't come up a lot, and you give a short half an hour talk, and this is what I'm referencing, so you probably can give us more information. The tombs that are found, are there any unique burial goods that have been uncovered in these excavation of these giant tombs?
Well, most of the tombs of the elite burials have, you know, your general bird feathers, birds, turtle remains, huge sea turtle shells. Either the burials on top of the shell, within the shell, under the shell. There are different stones and different shells that are placed on top of the burial, stone circles, pyramid type structures that are created out of the stones on top of the burials. Mm-hmm. But one of the more unique burials that have been found is of two females. It appears to be a mother and a teenage daughter in a highly inaccessible place on Aruba. And these are always, the giant burials are always secondary burials because they've been exhumed after they become skeletal remains. And the elongated portion of their skulls have been painted in a red ochre that is from locally sourced manganese. So there is recently, within the past 5 years, I believe, or 6 years, a skeletal remains found by accident by a man looking for bird eggs, actually. And he reached in and realized there were bones. And so the archaeologist came in. And this information is only published in one place. And I don't know why. And I have that study. They found within it a monkey. And the monkey was given the exact same burial as these two elite women, these two elite females. I mean, with its little skull was painted red and it had grave gifts too.
Wow.
And so the monkey, if you even go back to ancient Egypt, ancient India, you know, because a lot of women, particularly, this was a matriarchal society. And in my research, I believe this was a matriarchal society. And a lot of times men couldn't really have easy access to these women. And particularly if they were shaman. And so they would train monkeys monkey is to assist. In Khajuraho in India, where I've been, you'll see monkeys holding palettes of makeup for women to paint themselves. So they were, these monkeys were like, they're kind of maid-in-waiting, you know, this kind of someone that they used as someone that was a confidant in a sense, even though it was an animal. And so that was probably the most bizarre burial found. Bizarre in the fact that there are no monkeys in Aruba. So now you have to ask yourself what was going on at 7,000 years ago. Clearly there was some sort of trade, or was there a monkey population? This is the first one that was found. And now I found out from the head archaeologist that there could possibly be a second dual female grave with another monkey, with another elite burial. And that's the strange part. These monkeys were given these ornate elite burials that some of the humans didn't even have.
That's completely fascinating to see that. And they must have been revered in some capacity that we don't know about. Exactly. What makes you feel that this was a matriarchal society? Is it because the tombs are ornate, where we have women buried, or is there some other reason?
Yes, exactly. That's one of the main reasons. In Malmuk, the largest cemetery, there have been 72 excavations, but there are more bones in the land. This land is now protected in Aruba, and no building is going on there. And in the center of this burial site, which contains burials in the shape of isosceles triangles, by the way. In the center is this female, and she's actually the oldest person in the burial in the cemetery. She's alone, so she's not part of any of the isosceles triangles at all. And she has the most ornate burial of all the burials. And she also has a humped back, which is quite interesting. One of the hypotheses is that people who were born with some sort of genetic defect, shall we say, were actually exalted in a way. And she might have been one of those people. And it's not only through that burial that we can see this, as well as other elite ornate burials of other females in the population, but we also see the existence of cupules. And the cupules are in the form of, in some cases, belly buttons. So these belly buttons of these stones that look like they're pregnant. And this is a common theme found globally, that you will see a stone figure that has a bulbous end on one end, as if the stone is pregnant, and then this indentation in it. I've actually even seen them on Easter Island as well. Mm-hmm. And so cupules are the oldest form of rock art in the world. The oldest, I think, existence is in Western Australia, and it's about 400,000 years old. So that usually denotes a very female-heavy presence. And you will find entire panels with these cup marks. And they're usually facing some sort of cosmic event, whether it be an equinox or a solstice. And there is ritual attached to it. Even when you speak to the local people, the more modern inhabitants of the island also talk about these being sacred sites. And these cupule sites are all around sites that are considered spiritually significant, such as petroglyph sites, monolithic sites, megalithic sites, etc.
Wow. My guest has been Heather Arnold. Her upcoming book is tentatively titled The Island of the Giants, The Lost Race of Giants of Aruba. And this is fascinating. I want to ask you, as we conclude, Heather, you've seen these Paracas skulls. They are phenomenon. They're really a phenomenon. We don't have a great deal of buy-in from current anthropologists or anybody, simply because I think they don't want to touch them. But what's your feeling on similarities? Because Paracas, Peru, isn't that far away from Aruba at all.
Right. You know? And I've seen the Paracas skulls, and I've been to Peru and seen them. I think there could be very well be a connection, just like you say, geographically. Aruba and Peru are not far apart at all.
No, no.
And easily they could have had communication, even by land, if they had just taken a canoe over to Venezuela and trekked over to what is now Peru. So I from the Paracas skulls, their skull elongation is different. And actually, the plates of the skull, they have less of the sutures. But I think there is a connection. I think they maybe the Paracas skulls were an earlier version of these giants that might be more of a hybrid. Because of the elongation of the giants of Aruba is in a different position than the Paracas skulls. The Paracas skulls seem to be smaller than, like I said, the ones in Aruba. So at some point, these people became giants. But I do believe there's a connection. I just think it's hard to ignore it, particularly geographically speaking, the proximity.
And
the burials too. There are some similarities with regard to the burials as well.
One last question: if these islands are so close, I think you said 16 miles from the mainland, are there references that you discovered between the mainlanders and the islanders at all?
Yes. Well, up until 1528. Aruba and Curaçao and even Bonaire were considered the islands of the giants. And there was a petition put in by the Spanish government that the people of what is now Venezuela would also control those islands. And those islands were called the islands of the giants. Also in Granada, there was a monk, essentially, who lived there and was in charge of all the Catholic churches that were being built in the islands. It was based in Granada, and they were trying to build a church in Aruba, the southern tip of the island, and it kept being burnt down by the giants. And there's actually references of that.
Oh my God.
And he also referenced finding a femur of the giants and getting a hold of one because he wanted to show the Vatican that there were giants on these islands. So he got a hold of a femur and he put it on a ship destined to Europe. And the directions were that it must go to the Vatican. So lo and behold, it never got to the Vatican. No one knows where this femur is. But this was a concerted effort to try to prove that there was physical evidence of the giants, and then somehow this bone is missing.
Heather, I am really looking forward to your book. You're an enthusiast and a good researcher and tons of knowledge. Your book probably could grow into an encyclopedia with the amount of data that you're collecting. And it sounds like that video that you sent me is just the tip of the iceberg. You probably have volume 1 and volume 2 of the giants.
Exactly. You got it. You're absolutely correct.
Hey, tell people how they can get a hold of you and get more information. What's your website?
So I'm very active on social media. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I have a YouTube channel, Heather L. Arnold, and I also have a Facebook page, The Islands of the Giants. I'm also the administrator of the Facebook group, Stones, Bones, and the Paranormal. And I will be speaking on October 29th. In London at the Nephilim Anthropology Conference, which is a hybrid event, so you don't have to be in London to be a part of it. This will be my third time speaking there. Cool. And I'll be speaking more on the anatomical differences of the giants between the giants and modern humans. And you'll be pleased looking for my book very soon. I will be launching it from the island of Aruba.
And you're going to be moving there permanently, but before the end of the year or next year?
Yes, exactly. But after U.S. Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope they have good internet connection because we don't want to lose touch with you.
Yes.
And we want to announce the new book when the new book comes out. We want to make sure we get a part and promote that for you.
And my work is also published and entered into the National Archives of Aruba. My dear friend, Sir Doofy Cock, he has published my research in his book about these caves, these spiritual caves in this area of Aruba called Canachito. And he has entered this book into the National Archives. So my work is also in the National Archives of Aruba. So I really look forward to promoting the book from there. And they have excellent Wi-Fi, actually probably better than my Wi-Fi here in New York that I pay so much.
That's always a problem when you leave America. My friends who are in South America have challenges when it comes to keeping a good signal. Hey, as we depart, what's the deal with Giants, Heather? Why do we have, I mean, this history of the Smithsonian dumping volumes of giant skeletons and others, as you say, either losing the skeletal remains or they're misplaced or they're destroyed. What's the deal?
I mean, I used to think it was Darwinism, right? To protect Darwin. But I started reading Darwin's work and he mentions the Patagonia giants, for example. He mentions large statured people. Yes, he recognizes that there are large statured people, larger than the average statured humans. And he doesn't try to even explain it, just that they exist. So to think that it's Darwinism would be contrary, because he does acknowledge that there are large statured people that exist. So when I only can do it from my personal experience, I can surmise when I post something, I'm sometimes attacked, and I'm attacked by generally people who don't even follow me, but most importantly, people who are atheists or experts or both.
Or conservative scientists that don't want to rock their paradigm of research.
And I think there's a belief that if you acknowledge the giants and you're acknowledging the Bible, and this particularly the Old Testament, which goes into great depth about the giants in detail. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a concerted effort. And I don't hold, you know, a candle on either way. I don't know which way it goes. Just from my personal observation, I see that there are concerted efforts to disprove the giants. Maybe because that would prove the Bible was real. That's the only thing I could think of, because I can't think of why atheists are attacking me. I mean, I'm writing about the science. I'm writing from archaeological reports. So I'm not coming from a spiritual realm at all.
Unhappy when you say attacking you, they're saying, damn it, Heather, why are you spewing these lies?
Right.
Is that the story?
Where are the bones? You believe the Bible? And
I say, no,
I'm just telling you what's in the archaeological report. You know, if this correlates with what's in the Bible, then someone should say, wow, what's in the Bible? You know, I mean, that to me is just further research. And instead, people get very angry. So that anger seems to come from somewhere. And I think that might be, you know, if you're going to just upset the apple cart, you know, religion is one of those ways to do it. So,
okay, I gotcha. Hey, what's your estimated time for the release of this new book that you're heavily working on right now?
I'm hoping for this spring, so this coming spring, 2023.
Okay, we'll definitely have you on to promote that and give people a heads up with it. Hey, Heather, really a pleasure speaking with you, and continued success. By the way, I hope your transition, your move to Aruba is a smooth and easy move. Any moving I hate to even think about, but, you know, that's a big move. Not a few 100 miles. It's over 1,000 miles.
Yes,
right?
Almost 3,000 miles.
3,000 miles.
Over water. So it's and my car is moving with me too. So.
Oh my God.
Really a lot of moving parts.
That is a lot. Well, hey, I hope it's smooth for you, and we'll have to have you back.
Thank you so much, Cliff. I appreciate it.
Great to have Heather on the program. I want to mention the photographs that she has sent me will be available on Facebook. Go to Facebook, Earth Ancients. You'll see it on the international or the group page. You know, it's funny because I have not seen the monoliths in such sizes. And where they got these stones is anyone's guess, but they're fairly large. There's a small gallery of those. This unusual 8-foot skeleton that she photographed just a few years ago is on there, as well as other photographs. The two skulls that she mentioned that are missing are part of that gallery. And there's some other artifacts. It's a small, I want to say 10 photo gallery. If you're not into social media, just go to earthancients.com and find Facebook feed. They'll be on there. This is really kind of neat because, you know, it's hard to find giant bones. They either disintegrate because they're so old, they're not well preserved, or they're destroyed. And we talked about this at the very beginning of the program. It seems that it's really hard for the academic community to hold on to these bones for whatever reason. And, you know, it's a part of history that is unknown. We just don't know where these people came from, the genetics behind their great height, and their background. We just don't know anything about them. So whenever we can get some photographs and some artifacts, we definitely want to show them. So there's where you're going to find those details. Looking forward to this book on Aruban giants. And we'll definitely have her back just to say hey. And perhaps, I mean, she's mentioned to me that she's got a lot of photos. And I've just taken a few. So, and you know what? Check out her Facebook page. Heather L, as in Larry, Arnold. And you'll see some other photographs that she has there. So she's very active and very responsive. So anyhow, good luck to her on that upcoming book. Hey, I want to mention, if you're a fan of Earth Ancients, come out and join us on one of our tours. I just got the tour for Mexico, which is looking like fall of 2023. This is going to be with Dr. Edwin Barnard. He will be the leader. The reason that we are working with him is that he has access to some of these archaeological parks, most notably Palenque in southern Mexico. And this new itinerary is going to be shorter than normal. It's going to be a week, which allows for people to take just a lot less time off to join us. And it's going to be much more physically active. And we're going to try this out. He has been doing tours for years, and we're moving on to him. I will be announcing the Mexico tour real soon. Again, it's going to be fall 2023. If you're interested in joining us, we're only going to take a maximum of about 20, maybe 25 people. Send me an email to cliff@earthancients.com and say, hey, I want more information. Like I mentioned, I will be posting and talking more about the itinerary. But I just got it a few days ago, and I'm working it up, and we're getting more details. That is one to consider. Now, the Grand Egyptian Tour is already booked. It's scheduled for May 2nd to the 14th, 2023. This is not to be missed. We're about half full, and I think one of the reasons we're filling up quickly is the price. It's about 40% off the typical price of about $8,000 to $9,000. Our price is half that. Plus, we're giving an additional discount when you use the code GOE200. You'll get a few hundred dollars additional, which is only good for this year to register for the tour to Egypt. For more information and the entire itinerary, go to earthancients.com/tours, T-O-U-R-S. This is not to be missed. This is a classic tour. If you've been listening to the show, we've had a few people on the tour who have remarked about their experience. It is what we call the diplomat tour. Why is it the diplomat tour? Because you are treated like a representative of your state, your city, of your household. You're a diplomat. It's really a VIP tour. It is amazing. The food is outstanding. The bus, the planes that we fly are just wonderful, and it is private in many, many ways. We have private access to the Great Pyramid. Yeah, we get to go in the Great Pyramid for 2 hours on our own without the public. We're going to see amazing temples, amazing ruins. It is a once in a lifetime, simply because we do not have to interact with the general public. When you're standing in line for hours, like you're at Disneyland, it is a drag. We do not stand in line. We enjoy complete access to every place we go, which is why Mohammed Imbrium, in my estimation, is the best tour guide in all of Egypt. Again, it's May 2nd to the 14th, 2023. This is a classic tour. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours. Come out and join us. By the way, my guest next week is Bibhu Dev Misra, who is an author. We are speaking about the Mahabharata and the wars for Earth. This is something that I've been studying for a number of years related to the Black Knight satellite. My belief is that one of the craft that was used in this great war is still orbiting our planet. It is known as the Black Knight satellite. The war for Earth is discussed in great detail in the Mahabharata. We are going to discuss the various weaponry, the huge loss of life, and some of the aircraft that is noted in the Mahabharata, and other Vedic texts. This is a unique show, and it comes to us directly from India. All right, that's it for this week. I want to thank my guests today, Heather Arnold and the Giants of Aruba. As always, the team of Ruth Thomas, Mark Foster, and everyone who makes everything happen. You guys rock. All right, take care, be well, and catch us on Destiny every Wednesday. Bye-bye.